Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 172 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, presented by the iconic Empire Hotel on Manhattan's Upper West Side. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the finest character actors ever to come along. A regular in the movies of Spike Lee and the Coen brothers, as well as Adam Sandler and the Transformers franchise, to give you a sense of his range, and a Best Actor in a Limited Series or Movie Emmy nominee this year for his extraordinary portrayal of an eccentric lawyer on HBO's limited series, The Night Of, the great John Turturro. Turturro, an Italian-American who is 60, graduated from the Yale School of Drama in 1983, and while always maintaining a foothold in theater, almost immediately began racking up impressive screen credits. Small parts in Hannah and Her Sisters and The Color of Money soon gave way to unforgettable turns in other films such as 1987's Five Corners, 1989's Do the Right Thing, 1990's Miller's Crossing and Mo' Better Blues, 1991's Barton Fink and Jungle Fever, 1994's Quiz Show, 1998's The Big Lebowski, 2000's Oh Brother Where Art Thou, and 2002's Mr. Deeds, as well as in television fare such as the 2002 TV movie Monday Night Mayhem, the series Monk, for which he received his one prior Emmy nomination and won for Best Guest Actor in a Comedy Series in 2004, and the 2007 limited series The Bronx is Burning. But he may never have had a part as big or given a performance as complex and impressive as the one he delivered as John Stone, a Manhattan criminal court attorney defending a young man accused of murder, in Steven Zaillian's The Night Of, the 8 episodes of which rolled out on HBO between July and August of 2016, averaging 1.4 million viewers and collectively registering a 95% Rotten Tomatoes rating en route to 13 Emmy nominations, including Turturro's. Over the course of our conversation at the Empire Hotel in New York, Turturro and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them how seeing a clip at a young age of Dustin Hoffman helped him to believe that a fruitful acting career might be possible for an ethnic-looking kid, how his work with John Patrick Shanley and Shanley's material, especially in the Shanley-scripted Five Corners, helped to bring him to the attention of many other top content creators, including Spike Lee, why he and Lee, and he and the Coens, hit it off and have worked together repeatedly, and how he has cultivated close working relationships with other filmmakers as well, including Robert De Niro and Robert Redford, why he initially felt deeply conflicted about signing up for The Night Of, and why he ultimately found the project to be creatively challenging and satisfying, what we can expect from his next directorial effort, Going Places, the Coen brothers' approved spinoff of The Big Lebowski about the Jesus, the character he played in that film 19 years ago, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. John, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. We always begin just with the basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Brooklyn. I think it was Kings County Hospital. But I grew up in Hollis, Queens, and then we moved to Rosedale, Queens. My father was a builder. He was a carpenter, contractor, and then house builder. And then he worked on a lot of big buildings. Yeah. Actually, he did those buildings right across the street.
Really?
Lincoln Plaza, the both 1 and 3 Lincoln Plaza, where the Lincoln Plaza theaters are.
Yeah.
I worked with him on those jobs.
Seriously?
Yeah, I actually did a lot of sheetrock on the building and in the movie theater too. And my mother, she wanted to be a designer, but she was a dressmaker, yeah, and she worked with her brothers in a big band, and then she didn't want to do that for a living. And then, you know, she raised us, and yeah.
And how many siblings?
I have an older brother, yeah, and a younger brother. Nicholas is my younger brother.
And for you guys, were movies, TV, theater, were those big parts of your life growing up? Or
movies were the Million Dollar Movie, which was the same movie, was played five nights in a row, which a lot of people grew up with. Chiller Theater, there was the other one. There was one on Channel 11, Creature Feature. So yes, Channel 5, Channel 9, a lot of old movies.
Yeah.
And so I grew up on a lot of movies because my parents loved them from the 30s and 40s, even though I was a little kid, you know, in the 60s, really. And then all those great movies came out in the 70s.
Yeah.
But I didn't really get introduced to theater until I was a teenager, really. Then you could see all these Bob Fosse shows, you know, I remember seeing the commercial for Pippin.
Really?
And then it was a famous commercial.
Yeah, yeah.
When they did the slow dance with Ben Vereen. I think Anne Reinking, Reinking is one of the two dancers. And I went to see that, and I was really, you know, it was all, because it was the way Bob Fosse did the show, I was very taken by that.
Was that what turned you on to the idea of maybe acting for the first time, or was that even earlier than that?
I mean, I fantasized when I watched movies, and I used to do impressions and things like that, and I loved, you know, the old movies. And then I think when I started, I grew up like with James Cagney and Edward G. Robinson and Barbara Stanwyck, Betty Davis, and then Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas, then Brando and all those. But yes, it was a combination of that and also seeing Dustin Hoffman in Midnight Cowboy. Clips, I was not old enough to go see it. And I was shocked because I was like, wow, he looks like someone like, who's like in our family.
Sense that, because up to that point, you know, I guess studio system had kept out ethnic looking people.
Well, they were. I mean, there was Edward G. Robinson, but there weren't a lot of those people.
Yeah.
So usually played, you know, the sidekick or an Indian, you know, a lot of people who weren't Indians,
like,
who were Spanish or Italian did that. People changed their names.
Yeah.
But then you saw, you know, Dustin and then Pacino and De Niro. And that was like a huge, you know, just opening in my mind of like, wow, you know, this is unbelievable. These guys that, you know, people that I've, you know, grew up around or something. And they were great actors too. It was just an interesting time to watch movies. But I was always, I had a deep involvement in it. And then when I saw theater, I thought, well, maybe that's something I could do, because I didn't know anyone in the movies except the man who lived across the street, who was a carpenter in Local 52.
Okay.
Yeah.
As I understand it, you start getting into it a bit in high school. You go off to, you know,
SUNY New Paltz.
Yep.
Yep.
And acted a bit more there, but majored in it there, right?
I majored in it there.
How did your folks feel about this? I know you're...
My father wanted me to, you know, be a lawyer or something like that, or a doctor, but I wasn't that great in science. But yeah, lawyer, I could, you know, he just said you have to have a backup. You know, he came from, you know, Italy here when he was six. So my mother she thought I was a good student. And then when they saw me perform, I did very well. I was very raw when I went to New Paltz, but I had very good teachers, Richard Bell, this guy, Joe Paparone, Beverly Brum, all these people who really kind of educated me and civilized me in a way, a sense that, you know, to put your energy into something that was, you know, good texts and educated me as far as reading and expanding my vocabulary and being introduced to Tennessee Williams and Shakespeare and Arthur Miller and Thornton Wilder. And so, you know, then they were encouraged when they saw that, but they were still, what are you going to do? So I minored in English. And then when I got out of school, I was a little shy. I did some showcases, but I didn't really know how to hustle. And I was a substitute teacher, actually, taught American history.
And that was one of several things that you did, but before going back to school at Yale for the MFA. And I just wonder, was that because you wanted to explore other things, or was it to appease your parents who wanted you to have a backup? Or
I didn't know what I want. I wanted to be an actor.
Yeah.
I wanted to be an actor. I always liked to write a little bit. I didn't know about directing. I directed a little bit in college, not much. So, you know, I went to bartending school just so I could make a living.
Yeah.
But I was always working, like doing these showcases off Broadway at West Beth with my friend Michael Bottoluco and a lot of people from New Paltz. And my teacher, Beverly Brum, had gone to Yale. And when I was substitute teacher, I thought about it. And And I had a good monologue. I did a actors, it was called an actors theater workshop. And mm-hmm. I did this monologue from a play that Jason Miller wrote called Lou Gehrig Did Not Die of Cancer. It was a good play.
Yeah.
My friend directed me in it and it was a really good monologue. And then I had a Shakespeare monologue from Richard II and I decided to audition for Yale and for NYU. And I got into both and I got a scholarship to Yale and I got a lot of financial aid from NYU, but it was a bigger package to go to Yale. And so, you know, it was a huge thing for me. I was like, because I just didn't know how to go to agents and slip, you know, my picture under the door. It was very intimidating for me. I wasn't shy as far as working hard or putting together a showcase or even investing my own money in it, but I didn't know how to, you know, go about that. And so when I went to Yale, I thought, well, this will help me become a better actor and maybe it'll, you know, then I'll get my master's. Yeah. I could maybe teach, or, you know, my, you know. And I did very well. Yeah. I did very well. I
mean, in a lot of plays, right?
Yeah, I was in a lot of plays. I was cast. Some people weren't cast that much. And that was sort of unfair, yeah. I think, in some ways, because we were all in school together. But one of my classmates was Charles Dutton and Angela Bassett, too. Mm. But Charles was really rock, everyone called him. He was really exceptional. And he's the guy who first did August Wilson, first play at the O'Neill, the Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And anyway, out of that, I got to go to the O'Neill after 3 years there, Lloyd Richards, and that's where I did John Patrick Shanley play, Danny in a Deep Blue Sea, and a Keith Rudine play, who was a classmate of mine at Yale.
Well, I want to ask you when the first movie opportunity was, because I thought maybe if I
was... It was before.
I was before, right? Okay, yes. So I was looking at the chronology trying to understand that. Right, yeah. So this, was that Raging Bull?
Yes. De Niro came to see a showcase of Tooth of Crime that my friend Michael Bottoluco, who was ahead of me at New Paltz, was in. And I guess he saw Michael and he saw me and he said, you know, I also sold him the ticket for $1, I think, too. And he asked us to come in and audition. And I had read the book because my father was an amateur boxer. I knew a lot about boxing. I used to collect fight films that Jim Jacobs used to sell in Ring Magazine, 8mm, showed them to my dad.
Yeah.
So we adapted this scene and we rehearsed it all different ways. And so when we went in for it, he went in first, I went in second. They didn't even have a script and they were very like, you guys have a scene, you want to show us? And Marty Scorsese was very nervous and De Niro was like, let them do it, let them do the scene. And we had to move the table. It was a glass table.
Yeah.
And it came off the bottom. Jeez. And all four of us had to move it. And we did this scene. And I think we did I don't remember, but obviously we did a fairly good job. But we were very young, like, you know, I was 20 or something. And so they brought us back for auditions for these roles, even the role of the brother, but it was more the brother's friend, Salvi, and stuff like. And so we read all these. I went for a series of auditions to Marty's apartment.
Yeah.
And Michael got one line, a scripted line, and then I had like one unscripted line.
Hey, Jake.
Yeah, hey, Jake. And, you know, he always remembered that. And then I think when I did Danny in the Deep Blue Sea off Broadway, he came to see me. And a friend of mine was in a movie that he was making, Jane Kaczmarek with Meryl Streep. The movie he was making, they were like two married people having an affair. I forget the title. Anyway, he told her the whole story. You know, I've since worked with both of them, and Marty's executive produced a lot of things I've been in, and so it was a big, you know.
Even though it was just the line, it was a foot in the door.
It wasn't really a foot in the door, but it was just this unbelievable, like, kind of crazy experience. And it's weird, you know. I know both of them, and Robert I've worked with a bunch of times. And
do they remember all of this? From
Robert. Yeah, always. He told the story when we did What Just Happened to Bruce Willis and Stanley. We were in his trailer, and he said, "Yeah, John did this whole scene," and they were like, they couldn't believe it. They were like, you know, no one could get in because he came to see a showcase.
Yeah,
you know, and that's years ago. Agents used to come to showcases, and he always. I mean, that's how he cast all of Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Joe Pesci was retired.
Right.
Captain Moriarty never acted. Frank Vincent was a friend of Joe Pesci's, you know. So they were looking around for... We were, at the end, too young, because he was 15 years older than us. But I remember reading all these... It was called Prize Fighter.
That was the title, called Prize Fighter.
Wow.
Well, okay, so after that, you do go back, you get your MFA, you come out, and you've spoken a lot about the fact that John Patrick Shanley took an interest in you and cast you in a number of things was really instrumental in bringing you to the attention of a lot of the filmmakers who you would later work with. So do you know what was the root of Shanley and you knowing
I think
about each other?
We just kind of connected because of the O'Neill. I mean, we did the first version of it, which he thought was too lightweight, you know, for him with me and Mary McDonald. But, you know, you're doing it 5 days.
Yeah.
But I think there was a connection. Then he brought me in to do like a big reading at Circle Rep because they wanted someone else. And then when they did it at this Theater of Louisville, he wanted me to make sure that he wanted to go really deeper with it. So I had to kind of go in and actually read again, which was okay, you know, because that was his prerogative. And I, you know, really went in there and then he said, okay, yeah, we definitely, you know, I think he knew I could do it. And I just like, we just connected on a lot of levels, you know. He was older than me. And I think that production when we did it in Louisville was really a big thing for John and certainly for us. I mean, I didn't know that we were going to do it in New York and I would have to do it 8 times a week.
Right.
So I didn't know how to calibrate that, you know. And then he really fought for me for Five Corners. And he even fought for me for Moonstruck. He wanted me to be
really?
Moonstruck. And I was almost in Moonstruck too.
Wow.
I mean, Nick Cage did a great job. And then I did Italian-American Reconciliation.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to work with John again
yeah.
something because I still... You know, we connected and I got something, and you need someone like that, you know, from that, you know, the Coen brothers who knew me saw me do a lot of things, but Five Corners, which wasn't a big hit, a lot of people saw me in that movie.
One of them was Spike Lee.
Yep.
That's right. I think the reason that he said the way you first came to his attention,
yes,
I think Five
that's
Corners.
Right. Five Corners.
Before Five Corners, you'd done a few other movies after Yale. I know you had the small part in Hannah and Her Sisters for
right.
Woody and The Color of Money.
Right.
And then again, Five
to
Corners.
To Live and Die in L.A.
Yeah.
I had to Live and Die in L.A. And I also had done The Sicilian with Michael Cimino before Five Corners, which was really a miscast film in a lot of ways. I was like making a film about all Jewish people and you cast everybody from like Norway. You know, that's how it was.
Right.
But I still learned a lot working on it, and I learned to stand up for myself and fight for what I thought, you know, what I felt was right. And I brought a lot of that to Five Corners on the set because I was like, this is not going to happen to me again. I'm going to kind of own it in a different way and collaborate. But I know so many wonderful actors. You need a part. You need parts. You need to show what you can do. And some people are more capable maybe than others. But I know there are many people who are really capable who maybe didn't get that opportunity or whatever. But then I think, you know, the combination of Spike and Joel and Ethan kind of opened things up for me. And Joel and Ethan kind of saw me in a different way because they had been watching my theater work.
And that was because you had gone to school with Frances McDormand?
Yes, and I knew, we went to see her Blood Simple at the New York Film Festival. My wife, Kathy Borowitz, was in school with us. And so we were all friends. And then
was she already with Joel Kahn at that
point? Yeah, after Blood Simple.
Okay.
But then we would socialize, but Joel and I got along, and then I met Ethan. But then they would come to, you know, if I was in a movie, I'd invite them.
Yeah.
Or if I was in a play.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they saw me. I mean, the whole genesis of the Jesus character was in a play I did.
Really?
You know, they saw it at the Public Theater. We'd like you to do something like that, you know.
Which play was
it? They were called 3 one-acts called La Puta Vida. I did 2 of them by Ronaldo Pravad. And so they'd seen me do a variety of things, not just, you know, a tough guy or a psychopath. I mean, after I played, I mean, Hines was a great role in Five Corners, but I got offered a lot of dark, dark characters.
Yeah.
And then, you know, through Joel and Ethan and Spike, you know, after Do the Right Thing, maybe, you know, I got to do other things for Spike, like in Jungle Fever and things.
For the purposes of chronology, I just want to mention.
No,
it's great. No, it's great. But I want to just make sure our listeners know that basically after Five Corners, which came out in 87 and introduced you, as you say, to a lot of these other guys who would be coming up after that, it seems like the next thing was Do the Right Thing in 89. Miller's Crossing in 1990, and then Barton Fink in 1991. That's a pretty big 1-2-3 punch. And I just want to ask, how did Spike first reach out to you? Because you've now worked something like 9 times together, I think.
Yeah, I've done a lot of cameos.
Yeah,
I've done like maybe, I would say, real roles in like four or five of his movies.
Yeah. Starting with Do the Right Thing. Yeah. And but you've joked that in other interviews that I've read to prepare that you are Spike Lee's, quote, Caucasian representative, close quote. You've also said, quote, I am actually black. Spike's never said that out loud, but I am, close quote. So just what are the reasons why you guys hit it off?
Well, we're 3 weeks apart.
Yeah.
You know, he's a real doer, and I think so. I'm a doer. And I just think we had a lot of references, cultural references. I grew up in a black neighborhood. He grew up in an Italian neighborhood. I think he saw, once we got to know each other, that I was, you know, I wanted to play the racist in the movie. I said, I would rather have play that role. And he saw, once I got comfortable with him and Ernest Dickerson, how comfortable I suggested lots of things that they didn't maybe even know about. And I wasn't trying to soft pedal it. And yeah. I really was behind him. And I think something happened in that movie which kind of cemented our, he saw that I was, you know, if I disagreed with something, we would have discussions about the end of the movie. All of us would, all the actors did, but I was straightforward. But I supported his, you know, vision, and we just, you know, trust happens through something.
Yeah.
There was no battle of egos before that. And then he, you know, told me he was going to do, you know, I think Mo Better Blues was after that. And then when he worked Jungle Fever, like he interviewed me about growing up and interracial relationships for, like, it was in my house. And it was like a 55-page transcript, I remember. And, you know, originally maybe that character was going to be like the main story.
That's
not
what
the,
I read.
The side story. And I worked on the script a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people, Spike encourages that with a lot of actors. But I worked on, you know, for the other characters, my father's character. And there was a lot of my own experiences in Jungle Fever.
Yeah.
And being sort of caught in between tribes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or races or whatever you want to say. And, you know, I've had a very interesting childhood because I was in a black neighborhood. I moved to a white neighborhood. Yeah. I got bussed out to an all black school. And then I wound up in high school, you know, in a kind of nicely integrated school.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when you have relationships with people, you learn to judge people individually and not as a group.
Yeah.
And yet I grew up, there was all kinds of terminology that was thrown around.
Right.
And it's still thrown around.
Right.
But I think when I saw Do the Right Thing, I recognized a lot. And Jungle Fever, I recognized the world that I knew. And I think those films are very relevant, and I think Spike has a lot to, you know, contribute. You know, sometimes people have pushed him to the side a little bit, and I think he's a terrific filmmaker, and, you know, he's opened a lot of doors and stuff, but a lot of stuff he did early on with humor, it wasn't just being didactic. And I think if you see, maybe the movie's not perfect, Bamboozled, for example. Mm-hmm. There are sequences in that film that are, you know, jaw-dropping. You look at it and you say, holy mackerel.
Yeah.
You know, he's honest. He's putting his finger on something. And, you know, he's one guy. And I would love to do something, you know, complicated, you know, with Spike again. And I've taken heat for different things.
Yeah.
You know, in Mo Better Blues was something that I took heat for.
How come?
Because the characters were identified as Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
There was supposed to be, it was like a running gag through the movie. But when he cut it, we lost some of the comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I told Spike early on, I said, you know, we should make the character, the father's Jewish and the mother's Italian. I said, because then this way, you know, which could be very true.
A lot
of people were in that. And, you know, they're just specific characters. But they were supposed to be almost like almost comic relief.
Right.
But, you know, when a movie gets cut, so it was a big thing about him being I remember him, he wrote an article, I am not an anti-Semite,
right,
on the op-ed page.
Right.
And we had our pictures, me and my younger brother Nicholas, plastered on the Arts and Leisure of me and Denzel with our arms around him. And the nature of jazz, a lot of managers took advantage of black and white people. I mean, people didn't make a lot of money on their records.
Right.
So there were certain groups that there were Jewish group guys, and there were Irish, and there were Italian guys too, but I was worried for him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember we even said it, and then of course, when you cut it out, you don't think about those ramifications. But people have accused him of being a racist, and so I've been in the middle of that. I mean, Joe Klein, very good writer, he predicted riots before he screened Do the Right Thing in New York Magazine. He said there's going to be riots in the theater.
Well, I want to just come back to that one for a second because it's, I think now 28 years later, considered one of the greatest movies ever, and got some newfound appreciation when I think it hit the big 25th anniversary a few years ago. And I just wonder, though, for you, if you could psychoanalyze yourself for a second, why would you have asked to put yourself in the position of playing the guy who's spewing some of the worst stuff here, the most, you know, the most vile stuff in the right. movie? And also, what was the shoot like for you having once that got going? Because this was a very right. diverse set, and I can't imagine, even though people know that you're not the character, it, right. it can't have endeared you to people.
No. Well, and some people it did.
Yeah. oh, yeah, right.
Some people it really did. I thought it was the more interesting character. I thought that's what the movie's about. I thought, yes, I understand this, and you have to kind of bring a humanity to it. And also, you know, a lot of times people are afraid or they're ignorant or they don't have knowledge. So they there's a provincialism that pervades groups sometimes, and beyond race, can be religion. You can be, you know, you're saying we've got to stick with our own, you know, and you can see that when you travel to certain places. So I thought that was the meat of the matter, and I'm not afraid. I don't care with that. When I started rehearsal, I didn't want to say the N-word and yeah. all these other... I was, and Spike said, speak up, speak up. And then I got more comfortable, and people got to know me. And then we on the set between him and Ernest and Wynn Thomas and Ruth Carter, it was a fantastic rehearsal process. It was great. The people who looked at me differently were people who had never worked on a movie, like the craft service people, because Spike gave opportunities to
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
We would see the dailies at LIU.
Okay.
So you're watching the same scene. So yeah. if I'm saying stuff five times in a row, people are watching that and they're saying, that's who he is. And there was a girl in particular who told me on the set, she said, she wouldn't give me like water. I would say, can I have a glass of water?
This is the craft service.
Yeah, and she told me she hated me. She said, I hate you. I never forget how she said, I hate you so much. And I told Spike, I said, Spike, you got to talk to her.
Yeah.
I said, and he was laughing, laughing. He goes, you're doing great. She said, that's exactly. I said, well, listen, you got to put me on the cover of Ebony when this comes
yeah.
out. I said, because I said, you know, people, I'm going to ride the subways.
Right.
And the interesting thing about it all was, first of all, I have a lot of fans or people who like my work
yeah.
are black,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I've only gotten tremendous reinforcement
yeah.
from the black community for my performance in that film. Okay. Never once. Not one time. So that shit, that does say something to me.
Never that, once have they criticized you.
No, or say, yeah. you know, you're that guy, you're that.
He
they
knows.
Never had that problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But a person on the set seeing it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, that's why I cemented my relationship with Spike, because I was like, no, you got to add this.
Right.
And
right.
he was like, oh, yeah.
you
know?
Were all yeah. into, yeah.
I was, because it's the nature of a I mean, unless you're always going to be the hero,
right.
but someone who, first of all, doesn't interest me, someone who looks the way I look, I'm not always going to play that kind of part. And I don't have this, I feel okay about myself as a person.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of, you know, good friends, and I don't feel like I have to be, you know, the good guy. And sometimes I've been in movies where people are always plays the hero.
Yeah.
And some of those guys can be the most... you know, I don't want to say, but it's the exact opposite.
Yeah.
You're exact. It, like, all the air in the room, there's no room for you.
Yeah.
And I'm really not that interested in that, because I think in life, what happens between people is what's the most interesting.
Sure. Well, let's continue chronologically and go back now to the Coens, because I wonder if you can help with understanding how Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink happened in such close succession. I think there was some actual overlap in the making of them, right?
They were writing Miller's Crossing. They told me they were going to write a part for me because they had seen me play different roles. And in the middle of it, they had writer's block. They couldn't finish it. And they wrote Barton Fink.
But Miller's Crossing still came
out
first?
And then they wrote Barton Fink. They never showed it to me. The last day we were filming Miller's Crossing,
right?
Because I wasn't in the whole film.
Right.
Ben Barinholtz said, there's this film, he said, John, and he goes, it's called Barton Fink. And I thought it was Bart and Fink. And then they gave it to me after, and maybe it was the following year. Like, I don't know when we finished it.
Yeah.
Because when we started, we finished, I think, in, we started in the winter, so maybe we finished in March or April. So it was not that they were editing that whole thing. It could have come out the next March, but it didn't. And that summer, we did Barton Fink. Right. And we held for the New York Film Festival, which was a huge mistake because we came out the same week as Goodfellas, and it killed us. If we would have come out in March, it would have been much better, I think.
And when you say it killed you, with Barton Fink, let's just say you guys...
No, Miller's Crossing got...
It got killed, right.
We just got steamrolled.
Right. So just to remind people, with Miller's Crossing, you're playing Bernie Birnbaum, the Schmata,
Schmata. He was supposed to be the matzah, but that was something they took from one of those other books, right, like a Chandler, and they couldn't get the rights to the matzah.
Oh, God.
So they called him the Schmata.
Well, this is the double crossing gay bookmaker. Yeah. And then
the tragedy of that movie is that Steve Buscemi and I were lovers. It's alluded to, and I killed him. You know what I'm saying? But I always told the Coen brothers, they said, you know, if you would have had a love scene or a post-coital scene between his character and my character, because his character spoke even faster than my character, Mink.
Right.
I said the movie would have been a success. And I said, that's why the movie was in the box. That was financial.
That's so funny.
And Steve and I said, you know, now with digital,
we could do it.
We could do the same, you know.
Well, so there was that one. And then with Barton Fink, who we'll remind people was this tortured New York playwright who gets his taste of Hollywood, I guess. Was he inspired by Clifford Odets specifically?
Yes, but in some ways.
Okay.
And in some ways not.
So you really, I know, poured yourself into the prep for that one, and I'll ask you in a moment just if you can share some of what you did, but just to contextualize how well it was received, premieres at Cannes, wins Palme d'Or, Best Director for the Coens, Best Actor for you, all this stuff, and then here was one that, as I understand it, it cost $9 million, grossed $6 million. So how...
It made its money back before it was released. In they were in the black before the movie was released because they sold everything.
The territories.
They sold all the territory, and it did very, very well in other countries. I mean, really well. Won like the David Donatello Award. I won in Italy, so it did really well. And in France, it did tremendously.
Talk about what you poured into that one, but also then what was the effect on your career thereafter?
Well, here it didn't do huge, but obviously people in the business saw it and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, they opened up. I mean, I wouldn't have done The Truce, La Tregua, with Francesco Rosi if I hadn't done Barton Fink.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have, you know, learned all about Primo Levi without doing Barton Fink. And so that's something that was a big education for me and a wonderful, you know, 5-year journey.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing leads to another. I think people say, oh, well, he can play a writer. Oh, he can be an intellectual.
Right.
Or he can do that. Instead of me playing, you know, the guy from, you know, always.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, within any genre, you can have a tremendous variety of people. Even guys who are blue collar, who can be a plumber, can be very different than another guy. But that's not normally how they're written.
Right.
They're not written about a guy who reads a book.
Right.
And I know people who do, who are electricians, but they're readers, you know, or they're philosophers.
Yeah.
Or so it does open up other things. You know, in different countries, for example, if I was in France or Italy, I would just be looked upon as a guy who looks like everybody else. But when you're not that, either you're perfect looking and you're in this thing, or you've got to have variety. And I've always been interested in that as an actor. I don't like to be the same or sound the same or whatever. It's fun for me because I come from theater, and you have to change. If you do an Endgame or the Cherry Orchard, it's different. I mean,
well, to that end, I just want to quote back something that was written, I think, in Newsweek after Barton Fink, because you'd already accumulated a variety of hairstyles in movies by that point. So I believe they said John Turturro is to hair what Meryl Streep is to accents.
Yeah, well,
it's not a bad compliment.
That's a great compliment.
And I think there are other parallels that we could get into, but that's just to what you're saying.
That's good. I mean, you know, your hair, your voice, your posture, it's all,
you can be chameleonic.
It's all part of it.
Yeah, of course.
And also, I'm going to tell you a story. I want you to go with it in a way. And if I do something like, you know, The Night Of or something, you know, I spent a lot of time, really, even though I'm from New York, kind of working on my voice because he was a lawyer. So I did a big warm-up, and I used a lot of expressions that are from, really from older New York, which is more of a Yiddish-inflected New York, when I would ride in cabs and, you know, guys would, it was a certain sound or a certain music that you would hear, and you would say, oh, wow, it's, you know, it's, so to me, that helped me get lost, you know, in it, besides all doing my old own personal work.
Another milestone along the way, a few years after those movies we already discussed, is playing Herb Stemple in Quiz Show for Robert Redford.
There's a different voice.
There's a different voice, a different guy, kind of guy altogether. Yeah. Just again, to remind people, this is the game show contestant who became a whistleblower during the whole Quiz Show scandal period. And that was amazing. And it seems to me that, from what I've read, you really connected with Redford because you were on that before pretty much anybody.
Yeah, I was the first guy. I mean, that's why I gained all that. I was getting all that weight and stuff. Yeah, because he there's other people he was considering and he couldn't get. So I was with him alone for a long time.
Now, Herb Stemple was and is still alive. Was he somebody that you...
I met, met
you
him.
Did?
Yeah. He was a fascinating guy. And, you know, when I saw the kinescope of him, I was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, and... Later on, you know, Redford was saying, well, you know, you could also play the other part. And I was like, no, I want to play, you know, Herb. That's the part I want.
Why were you drawn to it? And what was the...
Well, that's what they offered it to me. And also the script was even more balanced between them at that time. And then I think he skewed it, you know, right. It's his movie more towards the tragedy of Van Duren, which was a little bit dramaturgically invented because he took to it much easier than Herb did. And he didn't maybe think Herb would have the awareness, you know, to comment on it. And there was one scene that I always loved, and I thought we were going to do it, and then they cut it out. We never shot it, where Herb, you know, figures out, like, it's he's got the right message, but the wrong face. And I really think that would have, he was sitting with the lawyer at the end. It's like after he has the testimony, and he's saying that he would never... It balanced it out between them. He said that, and I always regretted that I never had a crack at doing that because I feel like if they took some liberties that way, they could have taken that. But overall, it's a terrific film, and he did a great job, and I just adored working with him.
Was that sentiment, though, that the character would have expressed the right message with the wrong face?
That's right.
Something that... In any way you connected to, in the sense
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's, I mean, he was very naive and he made a lot of mistakes and he had his own kind of craziness and his own kind of neediness, you know. But yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of stuff. What's in the news right now?
Yeah.
I've done so many films that have explored different aspects of what's going on. Now, I haven't made a movie about the Civil War. I was also a history teacher, and my father was from Italy, and he fought in World War II. So grew up with a lot of this stuff in my house, you know, from Quiz Show to stuff with Spike, stuff with the Coen brothers, to Primo, you know, just the Primo Levi film. I've been around this thing, and I've tried to actually be involved with projects that talk about it or in a way that's humanizing and but also hopefully, you know, entertaining too. But I find it the subject.
But even beyond that, and all of that is fascinating to see when one looks back at your career and sees these threads. But I'm saying, even just on a different level, that I don't know anybody who doesn't think you're one of the best actors there is out there. But there's also then the considerations that come up in movies, as opposed maybe a little less to in theater and maybe television, that because a guy looks a certain way, he's going to get certain opportunities. You've obviously overcome any of that to a large extent because you look at the great career. But at the same time, has any part of you ever yearned to be the guy who is the hero in the sense that you've talked about?
Well, you know, I think sometimes people have seen me like as the lead or something, or like European directors see me that because that's where they're from. So I look like them or, you know, so... Right now, I'm probably going to, I'm not sure I'm going to do it, but it looks like I'm, you know, I'm talking about doing it They offered me, they want to do a miniseries of The Name of the Rose, and the main character is William of Baskerville, mm-hmm. and they offered me the role. And, you know, of course, it's a European director who offered me the role, you know, and they just see me as me.
Yeah.
And say I have the right qualities
yeah.
to do it, and they're all different kinds of looking, you know, different kinds of people.
Yeah.
And they look, there's a variety of looks to people who come from the United Kingdom in the past.
Yeah.
Because the Romans were there too, you know.
And it's amazing. You've played like every sort of ethnicity there is. Right. It's incredible.
So, but it's so, sometimes I've come up against that yeah. and you feel like, ah, I wish, you know, but I've been blessed when I have someone like Steve Zalian, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Saying, well, this guy's name is John Stone. He's a New Yorker
yeah.
and you don't know what he is.
Right.
You don't know if, you have no idea. Maybe right. he changed his name.
Right. Right.
And that's it. His name is Stone.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I'm like, good. But the whole thing was about race and
right,
everything like
right,
that.
Right.
So I don't always want to be that other character.
Right.
But you can see it's in our country. It's this, you know, when you just saw what happened like
yeah,
last weekend, you just go, well, you know, history is real.
Mm-hmm.
People have said certain things and has led to horrendous results.
Mm-hmm.
History is real. There's no moral equivalent
right.
of, okay, provocateurs, you know, which maybe there are on the other side, but from someone who wears, you know, a Nazi helmet,
mm-hmm.
that's a symbol of, that's outlawed in Germany.
Yeah.
They don't let them do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, white supremacists, you know, slavery's was in the United States for hundreds of years, and we are still feeling the results of
yeah,
it,
yeah.
you know? And so I think history is, it's a weird thing because people, they trivialize it. They don't personalize it. And it's, you need to constantly, it's like tenderize mm-hmm. civilized people. Because when you hear some of the things that were said the other day, you're thinking like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, are you going back to like the elders of Zion, yeah. you know, that book where they say,
right.
well,
right.
you run the banks.
Right.
You're like.
But you're saying specifically not only what was said at the rally, but what came out of the president's mouth, right?
Well, he obviously doesn't know his history very well.
Yeah.
He doesn't. He could say, well, there's two sides to every story. But in reality is there are people who are armed marching who represent groups
mm-hmm.
that saying we are superior to you and we don't want anyone different. And of course they don't really know what they're talking about. A lot of these people have learned it online.
Right.
You know, their parents haven't gone through
yeah.
you know,
some of their parents have repudiated them already publicly
right.
from the ones
right.
that were at this thing last week.
I mean, this is, you know, this is real.
Yeah.
This is real. This is, and you all you have to do is fan that flame. It's happened so many times in history. And so these kind of things, like, yes, you know, as an actor or in my profession, you can try to make things that help the conversation
yeah.
or keep the conversation going or open people up. But if people are clutching
right.
to this kind of amnesia
right.
that they have, it's a terrible thing to live,
yeah,
the way
no,
to live.
For sure.
And people will be, you know, can be hurt. And will be hurt.
It's already
and,
just happened, yeah.
Yeah, and you see how history repeats itself.
Yep.
It can happen. People say never again. It can happen again. And so you don't need to scream.
No.
You don't need to scream out that, but you need people to stand up and say, this is not right.
Right.
And I don't agree with it. I understand this, free speech.
Right.
But there's also hate speech and there's guys with assault rifles
right.
going to a protest.
Right. So crazy.
Yeah.
Well, to go lighter for just a moment here. No, I think you know what, it's on everybody's mind right now, or
yeah.
it should be. So I
right.
appreciate that we talked about it. But to go lighter for a second,
yeah,
I believe that it was in the course of promoting Quiz Show that you went on SNL and for the first time crossed paths with one Adam Sandler,
yes.
and that has spawned one of the more unusual, I mean, I would say less predictable based on the rest of your work. This collaboration, you've done, I think, four movies, maybe more. Mr. Deeds, Anger Management, You Don't Mess with the Zohan, some other stuff. Some are pretty fun, but they don't resemble anything else that I think I've seen you in. So I wonder, what's that about?
You know, Adam, he liked me, and they asked me, like, they wanted me to be like the bad guy or something
yeah.
in Mr. Deeds. And I said, I don't want to do that. And I said, but I liked this one little part, and then I liked another little part.
Yeah.
And I said, maybe you could make it one part.
Right.
And Adam was thinking along those lines. And they just basically let me do what I wanted to do. You know, I designed my wig and my costume, and I really had a ball doing Mr. Deeds. I was like, oh, this is really fun.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, then after I did that, he was like, you know, I want to do this. And then he told Jack Nicholson
right.
that I was going to do Anger Management. And Jack Nicholson was a big fan of Mac, my first film.
Yeah.
And then I said I didn't really want to do it. And then Adam called me up and said, I told Jack that you were going to do it. And then I said, all right, well, let's just try to make it a little bit whatever.
Right.
And of course, I had fun working right. with Jack. And the Zohan, that's been going on for years because Adam would leave me messages as the Zohan. And I like Adam. We play basketball together.
Right.
And I actually think, you know, in Punch Drunk Love, in the Judd Apatow Funny People,
yeah,
I think he's actually a good actor, Adam, you know? And we get along. I knew his dad.
Really?
And his mom, and I know.
How do you know that?
His dad passed away. But I felt comfortable. And it depends what kind of experience you have
right.
when you're doing it. And like the Zohan, I wish they would have let some of my, I mean, I did a whole scene like in Arabic and it with translation. And they were like, I said, well, you got to guys leave that in. You know, yeah. I wish I would have had a little bit. I think the first hour of that movie is really funny.
Right.
And then the second hour gets a little
falls
bit.
Off, yeah.
But Adam is very good in the film. So it's good to sometimes do something a little outside your, it's not where I live.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not where I live, but I don't look down on things. I think it's very hard to do comedy, pure comedy.
The Boulder thing that might have helped him to see you in a comedic context happened a few years before any of those movies, which I guess would have been The Big Lebowski. Was that the first time that somebody had really given you the chance to just play a nutty guy?
Well, yeah, that was in like 97 or something like that. So, that certainly probably helped. And doing Saturday Night Live.
Right.
I only did it one time, but it was a pretty good show. There was humor in other roles
right.
that I've played, like Herb Stemmer.
Right, of course.
You know, you can see it. Or I did a movie, Grace in My Heart, which not a lot of people saw, mm-hmm. but it was a great role. And I loved working with Allison Anders on it. Some people saw that. And so I think they knew I could do that, but would I want to do that?
The Coens, I think, would have wondered if you'd want to do it.
You know, with the Coens, I've done, I mean, Oh Brother. I mean, that's a comedy.
Right,
you know?
Sure, for sure.
But it's a Coen-esque comedy.
Try. Well, okay, so I'd get murdered if I didn't ask you a little bit about The Big Lebowski. You're playing the Jesus,
right.
Very intense bowler, probably has inspired a lot of twisted people to lick bowling balls over
right.
the years.
Yeah.
Did you ever imagine that this movie would take on that kind of
No,
life?
I mean, I said I had done a character that was could have been the cousin of the Jesus.
Right.
And so they liked that and we were laughing. And then when I got the script, I was kind of disappointed because I was like, there's nothing here.
Not much.
So then I thought, I better like make something up because, you know, they're all talking about him.
Right.
So then they had extra time that day and they allowed me to suggest a few things. And they said, we figured you were going to come in. And I was very thin because I had done the truce and it was about 4 months. I was still very thin. And I tried to, you know, just go all, because it's only a few minutes.
Right.
So it's got to be memorable because they talk about it. But I didn't even get the movie when it came out. When I saw it, I thought Jeff was great.
Yeah.
But it went over my head. It went over my head. Then I saw it the second time. And then I was like, everybody was talking about it. Then I went to see it again with my older boy, Amadeo. And I was like, oh, I get it. This is really funny, you know? And I don't think audiences here didn't get it.
No, it didn't do well in theaters, right?
It did well, I think, like in maybe France and the UK.
Yeah.
But it's a movie you can, you know, guys take it into war with them.
Yeah, I guess maybe it's a beneficiary of that DVD boom that was
people really discovered it that way and they just watched it again and again. And because it's a great comedy team and stuff. And
so when you came in and came up with some of the business, though, what are we talking about? Was that the...
You know, licking the ball and shining the ball, dancing, all that stuff. Stuff that they... I said, you know, what about this? What about that?
Because I just watched that scene again this morning in preparation for this. It's only like maybe 4 minutes altogether, and yet that's a little mini masterpiece there.
Well,
people should go.
The first time they showed it to me, I was editing my other film, Illuminata, and they said, John, we want to show it to you because they were mixing it. I was really embarrassed.
Why?
I was like, I put my head down. I said, I can't believe you put all that stuff in there. I mean, I was doing it because we're friends.
Right, right.
You know, people have asked me, other directors, they've said, could you do something like you, like in the Big Lebowski? And I said, what did you say? And then they face dropped. I said, what movie are we making? You know,
yeah,
it's like, don't you ever ask me to do something like I did somewhere else. That's like, that's off the table.
Really?
If you don't have the imagination to come up with your own idea. And that's also, that's something I share with those people, with Joel and Ethan. And that's, I don't do that kind of thing. And if someone says that to me, then I basically,
that's the end.
Then that's like, kind of like I said, well, this guy, he has nothing to offer me.
However, though, is it the case that I've read that you have chosen to go and revisit the Jesus in
it is. I mean, if I would have done it like his cousin, like I did the other play,
right,
then people would have said, well, it's like the Jesus. So then I thought, well, I want to play it this way because I felt like I would like to do the full version.
Right.
The nuanced version, where that's more of the trailer version, right, of the Jesus, you know, the shorter, right, version. Then I showed the Coen brothers the book and French movie I wanted to adapt, and they loved it because they said, this sensibility is right for that. It's a continuation of the character exploration, but it's not a spin-off of the Big Lebowski.
Is it the same tone?
It's a different it's much more sexual.
It is.
Yeah, you know,
Do we find out why he was how he became a pedophile?
You find out that he was framed.
Oh, okay, I love
that he really, right, and he's a raging heterosexual. Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, he's more of a bisexual, right, in the film.
But
yeah,
this is like the Better Call Saul to that. Yeah, that was Breaking Bad.
So it's like a continuation, right, of the character of the exploration, but right, it's the sensibility is really more based on Bertrand Blier's original, right, book, but it is that character. It's where the character came from.
That's I can't wait.
It actually
wait.
Is the character.
And it's in the can, right?
Yeah.
Well, so I can't wait for that. But what you just said as far as like how you will shut down on a director if they come up with something crazy.
Well, it's bad. It's like saying, you know, if you're friends with Mike, you know, can you treat me, you know, and then you're with Steve. And
right.
Steve says, well, why can't you treat me the way you treat Mike?
Right.
You know, it's like
yeah,
no, I have my own relationship.
Right.
You don't ask someone to imitate something that they created.
No, for sure.
You
but
come up with something specific.
What I admire is that you will do that with, it sounds like, anyone, because it sounds like you were asked strange things even with like The Good Shepherd, which is De Niro's second time directing,
right,
and he started to go a little nuts with the amount of takes and stuff. What,
yeah.
Right?
Well,
and
he just likes taking lots of takes.
But like you, even if it's De Niro,
talk to De Niro. I would tell De Niro, I would say, well, now I'm bad.
Right.
Now I'm no good. And I said, well, I gave you 10 good takes. And
that's it.
You know, and I was like, I'll keep doing it. I said, but it's not going to get better if we got it, you know. But sometimes he just wanted on certain scenes more angles or this or that. And
did you
we
say?
Had a good, we had a good, very good relationship. But I would say to him sometimes, I said, Bob, I said, well, now it's, you know, now it's just an exercise of, you know, variety. I think we've got the choice.
But there wasn't a thing where you literally, that's it.
No, I would never do that to Bob. Because Bob doesn't, there's no that's it with Bob. That's it. We could still be filming The Good Shepherd now. We could still be filming. That torture scene, that went on for days.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that was really, like, horrendous to do.
Right.
You know? But I think the crew was going to, like, jump out the window. Because I was saying basically one line. For three days.
Oh, my God.
I was basically saying, like, what is your name? Tell me your name. But you know, once he found out these are the things you do, and and our advisor was quite, you know, he had done these things. I was basically doing.
Yeah.
I was doing, but the guy who I was torturing was a wonderful actor, and he was in the Israeli army. Otherwise, no American actor could have gone through it.
Would have told her?
No, they could not have gone through it.
All right, I'm telling
you.
That's hilarious. Okay, so now with our home stretch, let's hone in on what has been received as one of the greatest in this whole collection of great performances, and that is as John Stone, who we mentioned earlier, Manhattan criminal court attorney who has some personal issues with his, I guess you would say, hygiene and health and personal, you know, home life and all this, and yet is very great in his own way at what he does. And so I want to ask you, you've done TV before, you won a guest acting Emmy for Monk in 2004, you did the 8-part ESPN series, The Bronx is Burning in 2007, a number of things. But until recently, a lot of people who really made their name in film would not do TV. So right. For you, how did your outlook change on that?
Well, I think the most interesting stuff being done is on television, probably, because the types of films that were made in the 1970s are not being made.
Mid-range.
The mid-range, character-driven things. And you see all these actors, you know, from, you know, Bryan Cranston, mm-hmm. you know, Jimmy Gandolfini, you mm-hmm. know, all these people, you know, great actors being able to explore different things. And people love it. And the miniseries has always been an interesting form. BBC has done it so many times. I've adapted books, but 2 hours is not enough. You yep. need 4 hours. And I think people have gotten more hip to that. Like when we did The Bronx is Burning, we really didn't have the money to fully realize that book, which is a wonderful book, but it was still a great experience for me. And even when I did a thing about Howard Cosell on television with Ernest mm-hmm. Dickerson, that was a terrific experience too. It just was shorter. This, we had the time to do it, and Steve, you know, really wanted the time. Mm-hmm. And HBO, we did go long, and then we had to deal with that. But Steve and Richard together are two, they've written so many scripts, and they've rewritten each other. And they saw the original, which I never saw, but they said this could be longer. And then they looked at The Staircase, that documentary, and they really wanted to have that almost documentary type of approach. Yeah. So I thought, this is fantastic material, and Jimmy never really got to do it. He only did one day, and when they approached me, I didn't even know that he had done this.
Well, let me, just so people know what we're talking about here, you, first of all, had a long history with James Gandolfini.
Yes, I did.
He was not only in one of the movies that you've directed, Romance Cigarettes, but he was also, I read you were at his wedding, you were at his funeral. I think your sister even.
Aida knows him since Streetcar Named Desire in the early 90s, what he did with Alec Baldwin.
And then she was on The Sopranos.
So I know him since
all that stuff. Yeah, so he had, this had been a passion project of his. As you say, they only made the pilot.
Yeah.
And he wasn't
even he worked one day on it.
So how did the project first come to your attention? And then did the fact that it had been his make you more or less inclined to do it?
No, I didn't know about it. My agent knew about it, and Christina Bezdikas, and she kind of put me into the, I guess there were other people who were interested. I was someone that they were thinking of because Steve, you know, has always liked my work, and I almost did Searching for Bobby Fischer with him. And so I think I was on the initial list. James had a deal, and he found out about it, or they talked to him, and they went that in that direction. I didn't even know I was being considered for it initially. I had no idea. When they came to me, I felt a little strange, but I said, well, let me read it. So I read a couple, and I was like, wow, this is very good. Mm-hmm. I'll watch the pilot. Pilot was very long. It was very slow, mm-hmm. actually, I have to say.
The one that was previously.
And then they cut it down. And I felt weird. I said, oh, I'm going to see James. And, you know, it was just someone I really cared about deeply. And he was the lead in my movie. I worked with him for 2 years on it. And I still can't believe he's gone. Mm-hmm. I just can't. Just because of the kind of person that he was.
Yeah.
And then I saw, you know, he was interesting. But he only did he never even talked to Riz.
Yeah.
So I had was watching with one eye, and I said, okay, well, I'll read the rest. So I read the rest, and then I sat with Steve, and we talked. I did talk to Jimmy's wife and his managers, and they were all encouraging. And, you know, it was extra incentive for me, but I thought, this is great. You know, listen, if you were going to play Hamlet, a lot of people played Hamlet, but no one really played him except in England, really.
Right.
And you have to find your own way. And I had a good almost 4 months to think about it. I thought what was interesting, all the characters were really detailed and nuanced. But I thought what about Stone was that, well, here's a guy who has all the capacity to be a great lawyer, but not the Constitution. And it reminded me of so many people I know who have so much talent, so much ability, and they don't have that drive, or they don't have that coldness, or they can't compartmentalize.
You've probably seen that with actors.
I can tell you, people who... You would think this person's a great actor, this person's a great writer, and you don't know who they are. So I thought, then he's got his body who's rebelling against him, and that is a thing that people suffer from.
All that's in the script, or did you add some of that?
No, it's in the script, but the business stuff, I started doing more and more because I got to learn about it and work with my makeup man, and I wanted to physicalize it because so much of the of the movie is people talking
yeah.
in rooms. So we needed that physicality.
Yeah.
So I thought, hey, guys, let me do my blocking and figure stuff out a lot. And I can bring that, and I can bring a physical life to it also. But, you know, I just loved playing the character. And if they want me to explore that again, I would. Because I felt like he's like Lazarus in a way. He's just, he takes on all these things of everyone. And he's this cynical guy. And a lot of people who are cynical are really idealists. And he's a real ideal. Underneath, he hasn't lost that part of himself. Even though he knows, you know, he's almost like an investigator lawyer, you know. But I spent a lot of time with really successful lawyers.
Yeah.
And you could see the cost it has for some of these guys. They're like, I don't know how long I can do this,
yeah.
you know. And I know Bill Camp, and I thought Jeannie Berlin was fantastic. And Riz and I just kind of hit it off.
Most of your scenes, I would say, are with him,
Riz
right?
and Amara. A couple with Jeannie and a couple with Bill. And I have a lot of people I interrogate, I investigate, which are all interesting actors.
But with Riz, it's an interesting dynamic because you're somebody who's a bit older, so much more experienced. Also, there are parallels with the characters. What was that dynamic like? You're both now nominated for Emmys together.
Listen, we worked together. And I told, you know, what's interesting is what happened between us, not separately.
Sure.
And I think the strength of The Night Of is what happens between the characters.
Yeah.
And not just, they don't exist in isolation.
Right.
And Riz was struggling doing his role because, you know, Steve really didn't want him to do very much in the beginning. He wanted to kind of keep him quashed in a way and contained. And it was very difficult for him. And so he reached out to me and I reached out to him and we talked about it and say, it's the difference between being squashed or being just simple
right.
and being minimal.
Right.
And you're going to get to do all those other things. And he kind of depended on me in some ways that way. And it really helped. And I also think very highly of him.
Yeah.
He's very smart, very dedicated. You know, I care about him. I hope we continue to be friends and maybe we do something else together.
Great.
I think he's really special guy, but you know, these kind of things, it's like the competition in acting really goes within you. It's with you and yourself.
Yeah.
And it's just like, how far can I go? And then I throw it out to you.
Yeah.
And then if you receive it, you throw it back to me, then we've got something going. You know, sometimes the actor off camera can help make the other person's performance. And you know when you have someone generous doing that because you're saying, God, I don't have to do anything. This person is doing my whole performance. I just need to react. And I think, to me, I try to keep it in that context.
Last question is this. As I understand it, about 10 or 11 years ago, you had, I don't know if you would call it a midlife or mid-career crisis sorts. And basically, you really seriously thought about walking away from all this.
Right.
And I wonder, what do you think that was all about? And can we count on you to stick around and do more of this?
Yeah, I think you can count on me to stick around if you'll have me, if people will have me. Yeah, I think everyone goes through that.
Yeah.
I think everyone thinks, well, you know what? I took this road. I could take that road. Because I think when you do things that have real resonance and quality, it doesn't have to always be heavy. It can be a really smart comedy or something. You feel like you're making some kind of contribution. And then sometimes you feel like, well, what am I doing? You know, like a doctor saves somebody's life. You know what I mean?
Because that's what you were thinking about
doing? Yeah, I was thinking, my doctor was laughing in my face, Dr. Kotnick.
Because you said to him, I want to do what
John,
you do.
He said, you're too old.
to become a doctor.
Because you do a good thing. You know, you help people too. You know, when they're sick, they watch you and they cheer people up or, you know, distract them. And so, you know, I think everyone hits that age where you think, well, you know, I wanted to do this, you know, because you want to feel like you make a contribution to the world and not just, you know, people recognize you. What the hell is that? I mean, it's like nothing to me. I like when someone says, you know, you cheered me up or you make me happy or, you know, you brought something into my life. And then you feel like, you know, the kind of work that pays for itself, that, you know, you give something away. That's the whole idea for me.
Well, I think you have contributed a lot, and I know that it's very appreciated by a lot of people, including the people who are going to be listening to this. So thank you so much for doing
thank you.
It.
It was
I appreciate
delightful.
It.
Okay,
yeah,
really,
thank you.
Real pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.